7 Breaking Cafe with Baudrin and Barry with me from the new Palatial Studios. Yes, I said the new Palatial Studios. That will all be explained. It's Mr. Barry Rose. Bear, how you doing today, my man?
I'm about $500,000 right now, Jeff. Usually I'm $1 million. Right now, about $500,000. But I get a feeling by the end of this episode, I'm going to be $2 million.
Well, okay, then. That's what counts. So on today's award-winning episode, we are going to be looking at some great wrestling angles from the past. No, we did not do a match of the week this week. No, I said no. I reached out to the group. I said, we're going to throw you a little curveball. We're going to discuss great wrestling angles. And I got to tell you, Barry, one of the things that really surprised me, very happily so, was I picked an angle from a smaller territory. And when I say smaller, I mean, it wasn't exactly, you know, like the WWF, wasn't the NWA or, you know, WCW. It was a territorial angle from 1982. And we're going to be joined by the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, to talk about a Southeastern angle that he has a great memory on. Have a great discussion with Ron about that. Then we're going to go to WCW April 20th, 1988 was still considered the NWA. And we're going to be talking about a great angle from Jacksonville Barry Windham is going to join the Horsemen. What? He turned his back on Dusty Rhodes. I can't friggin' believe it. And we're going to be talking about a bunch of other stuff. Discussing our movie tournament that's ongoing. By the way, Barry, I don't know if you saw it today. Did you see what today's competition was, my man?
Today was the Sure Thing versus Beverly Hills Cop.
Exactly. And it looks like that's a sure thing. The winner is a sure thing. Not the movie, right. A sure thing, but the winner of the contest is going to be a sure thing. So I did want to mention one thing, Barry. The reason I was so happy about Ron Fuller's territory coming in is because two of the angles that I had mentioned were both WWF angles from the early part of the 80s, and they both came in last. Neither one of those angles, shockingly, got even 5 votes in our group, which absolutely stunned me. And I guess if somebody wants to talk about those angles, maybe they should stick to wrestling, Barry.
Oh, I like
it. Wow, you know, we are nothing if not a well-rounded podcast.
The first McAdams shot of the day.
Well, swing, and it's a fly ball to left. I don't know if it's going out or not. So, and of course, we'll have a few other things to discuss. But before we get into that, Barry, it's time for us, as we are wont to do, to break kayfabe on life. Are you ready, my man?
Fire!
Somebody asked for that.
They did. Brian Huff. I am ready, Jeff.
So, you know, Barry, one of the things here on Breaking Kayfabe that we talk about is that we don't talk about just wrestling or movies, television, music, that we also talk about life. And as the great John Lennon once said, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. And so we have a little something to discuss with the folks today. I should say Barry has a little something to discuss with the folks today because you know, one of the things when we first started doing this podcast, I always took the advice of Howard Stern, and Howard Stern always opened himself up to the audience, and he wanted the audience to know what was going on in his life, because it feels like to him that it makes him more, you know, the audience more part of his show and part of his life. And so so we have a situation like that today, and Barry wanted to talk about some stuff, and I'm going to, on the backside, talk about a little bit about how this is part of my life too. And so, Barry, let's just say that, you've, undergone some changes in your life.
I have. And it's, you know, and you're right about the Howard Stern thing, but I think for me, and this is the part that'll be funny, I guess, in some ways, as this story, as we get into it and we start to discuss and this whole thing develops, is I don't necessarily share a lot of personal things. And that's certainly ironic coming from a guy who talks about shitting on lawns, right, Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, considering that I've discussed multiple fecal issues on lawns, I don't always get into my personal life, but I would assume for the last year and a half or so, it's probably for good reason. The end result, and we'll certainly discuss it, is that I am single. And for some people, that may come across as a shock. For others, it's not going to. And a lot of that is, I have received a few messages from people, and it usually is based off of my comment that I've been living in the basement for the last year. And where I say that, I think I tried to say it on a humorous aspect, but at the end of the day, it was legitimate. So I'll go back a little bit. My wife and I were together, and legally, we still are married. We're separated. I am living in a luxurious apartment in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, where, Jeff, there are no Quakers in Plymouth that I'm aware of, which is a private joke that you and I shared with Sweet Lou off air. But I don't know exactly where to start and how far back to go, but my wife and I got together in 1995, and it was early 95. It was right around Valentine's Day. And I was older, I'm at this point, as you and I also joke, we're about 90% older than everybody at this point, but I was almost 9 years older than my wife at the time. And my wife was 22 years old. And when I saw her, I immediately was just taken with her. And I don't know if I fell in love with her right off the get-go or it was a crush, but I can tell you, I looked at her and immediately I was just absolutely smitten and taken with her. And we were working together, Jeff. It was the cardinal sin of, I was the restaurant manager and she was a server. But I was so taken with her on so many levels and realized the recipe for disaster would be me staying in the restaurant that actually within 2 months of dating her, I gave my notice and I quit so that I wouldn't be working in that restaurant with her and we would be.
And again, you want to clarify that you were a manager, not just a server.
Dare you? How dare you?
Thank you. I just want to clarify.
Yes, I was. I was a manager and she was young. I certainly wasn't young, but as we also talked about off air, look, we're guys, we're immature. So my wife and I, my girlfriend at the time, were on a very similar plane as far as emotions and things like that. And certainly she was probably even more emotionally developed than I was at that stage. But we were the best of friends and obviously developed into a long-term relationship. We were living together. I would say within the first month, we had started living together. We just were inseparable. We were just always together. And I didn't want to be anywhere. The important thing was this was maybe the happiest I had ever been in my life. And I remember saying to her, it was probably a couple of years later, there was one day I was just, living in New York, it's the middle of summer and I'm on top of the roof on a lawn chair, eating, drinking, just enjoying the weather and thinking to myself, this might be the happiest I've ever been because I'm just so relaxed. And she was the major component for that because, everything we did together. Whether we saw 1 year, Jeff, which was within our first 2 years of dating, we saw 80% of all the Knicks home games. And we did it together. We saw movies, we ate, whatever it was. We were the best of friends who were having a great relationship. And we got married about 3.5 years later after we started dating. And it was a great marriage. Certainly in the beginning, it was a great marriage. And we moved around a little bit. We stayed in New York after 9/11 hit. And it's something I don't talk about too often, but we were impacted to some degree by 9/11. My wife at the time working for NBC and the whole big anthrax scare. And it was a really tough time. And we also had a baby at that time who was Zach. Zach, who was about 7 months old when 9/11 occurred. And we made the decision to get out of New York, made the decision to go in the suburbs of New Jersey. Then I was offered a good position at Universal Studios in Florida, where I saw you, Jeff, with your family for the first time in quite a few years, just coincidentally. And
did not perk my meal, but that's another story.
There you go. Did not perk that meal. And my daughter was born while I worked at Universal Studios. And I stayed there for a couple of years and had a great opportunity to come up north with a major restaurant chain. And my wife, being from this area, made the decision that we were going to move up, and we did. And I think initially it was a great move. And my wife and I continued. I think we had a really solid, strong marriage for a while. And you know, there was a period, I'll say this was 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, that there was a rocky patch. And as all marriages, you know, look, I won't be the first guy to tell you, you know, and Jeff, you certainly can chime in. And even Sweet Lou, who's working on his first marriage, it's, you know, you're going to have ups and downs. And at the end of the day, it's incumbent upon you to try to make that work. That, you know, nothing is perfect in life. So we had a rough patch. And I should say, too, the rough patches were never based on anything like cheating or anything, you know, to that regard. It would never, I've never cheated on my wife. I, you know, fully believe she's never cheated on me. It wasn't about that. And really, it was about two people that had grown apart. And it was two people that were very different. You got to remember, too, when I started dating my wife, she was, you know, months out of college. She was 22 years old, and everything about her was everything I was looking for. And now, 26 years later, you know, she is different. She's a mother of a college student. She's a completely different person. And I want to think to some degree I've evolved a little bit for the better, but you know, she is a totally different person, and she's not the person that she was when we got together. And I think a lot of the way that we view things is completely different. And I should say, too, you know, let's get this out of the way. This was an amicable separation. There's, you know, I actually talked with her today. We were texting last night. And also, to be very clear, there's probably almost no chance of a reconciliation. And that's not being said out of anger or anything like that. It's being said out of this is the best situation for all parties involved. So why did I decide to go public with this, Jeff? And really, I decided, you've known for months, you know, Sweet Lou is known for quite a while as well. And there are certain people that I have confided in. It's a very small group. But there are a few people that are aware of it. But I didn't want to lie, and I didn't want people, you know, you're right about the Howard Stern thing. He's for the most part, is pretty honest with a lot of his listeners. But for me, it was more, I didn't want to lie, and I didn't want to pretend like, you know, when somebody says, oh, how's your family? Oh, everything's great. I didn't want to be that guy. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to break kayfabe in the fact that, you know, much as you talked about your battle, your war with cancer, and, you know, I didn't want to basically sweep this underneath the rug and then have to address this in 6 months. I should say, too, one of the things that I found most interesting, I guess, over the last year, as I'd lived in the basement, Jeff, was the amount of our group members and our listeners, but our Facebook group members that are going through something similar. And I'm not certainly not going to out anybody, but I've had several people contact me and, you know, tell me that that, you know, my wife and I are separated or getting a divorce for whatever the reason. You know, there is one gentleman, a very great guy, Drew Samuels, who has been he's been very public about his separation. He's got three young daughters. He's got older kids as well. But, you know, he's been very, very public. But there are quite a few people that are going through this right now. And, you know, I had a conversation with someone yesterday, Jeff, who was in our Facebook group. And it's somebody, again, I'm not going to mention a name, somebody that I have that you have met at our fan fest that we do down in the beautiful city of Lutz, Florida. And he's been having a really hard time emotionally and mentally. And I reached out to him, and he asked for some advice, and, you know, the last thing you want to do is ever throw advice to somebody. But he asked, and I said, you know, this is the way that I look at things. And I hope you can see that. And I can hope you see how valuable you are as a human being. And we had just this great conversation, but there are a lot of people in our group that go through things on a daily basis. And if I, much like you did with your cancer, if we can talk and give anybody, and just for 5 minutes, maybe relieve some of the angst or some of the internal strife that somebody might be going through, that's what's really, really important. But getting back to Drew Samuels, Drew shared something with me, and I shared it with you a couple weeks ago, and I wanted to share this with everybody in the group. And I asked Drew, and God bless Drew. He said, please, please share it. I just thought it was so impactful for me when I read it. And even thinking about it, I'm getting goosebumps. But he has an older daughter. I believe he said that she was 21 years old. And she lives, they don't live in the same city, so he doesn't see her on a daily basis. But he got together with her, and he played, I guess he played the episode where we discussed his situation and how we were in his corner. And his daughter and he both started crying, and his daughter, I guess, was bawling her eyes out. And Drew was like, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, did I breach something that should have stayed personal? And she said, no, Dad, I love you. And I'm so happy that, you know, you've got all these people in your corner. And I had to read that, Jeff, you know, a couple of times to truly get the impact of it and to truly understand what a beautiful sentiment that was. And we've said it, you know, multiple times that, you know, if there's a legacy, if this podcast was to end tomorrow, which, you know, it's not, but if this podcast was to end tomorrow, the fact that so many people are so good to each other in a world that right now, you know, it's kind of shitty and has been shitty for a while, that people are so good to each other and people are so supportive of each other, there's nothing more valuable than that. You know, that is just so important. So end result, you know, if me talking about this, A, it is being honest, which I definitely wanted to do, but, you know, to understand that my life will go on. My wife's, who is still legally my wife, her life will go on. And I want to think that we're both going to be happier. I certainly have felt here's the irony of it all, Jeff. The weeks leading up to this, I was, I thought I had an ulcer. Like, you know, there was this feeling and I wasn't sleeping. I was in massive distress. And once I made the move, a sense of relief almost came over me, you know? And I will say, again, being very honest, there were two things I think that really upset me. And I should say also, you know, certainly I was upset by the dissolution of a relationship that was over a quarter of a century. But the two things that really scared me, one, which was the most important, were how are my kids going to react? You know, one of the things about my wife and myself is we've always been really, really hands-on parents. You know, I was never a dial-it-in kind of guy. You know, I took Zach to his first concert. I took Zach to we did everything. And with Zoe, it's been the same. And I talk to my kids, at least I make the attempt with Zach. He's in college and Lord knows living the life now. But, my kids were my world. You know, they still are. They're everything to me. And how is this going to impact them? And luckily, you know, Zoe was very understanding. Zach had some issues with it, but also he saw the bigger picture after a couple of days, and that mom and dad were going to be happier. And isn't that what you want for anyone that you care about? That you just want them to be happy. And he really got that and really came around and really understood that. My second aspect, which I won't get too deep into, was the financial aspect, and that, you know, I wanted to do the right thing by my wife. And it was, you know, even if it took me biting a bullet, I didn't want to walk away with any sort of battle in any form. And, you know, I heard a stat the day we went to the lawyers, and the average divorce cost $12,000. I have a very good friend who that I work with, who shall remain nameless for the obvious, who has spent upwards over $100,000 in her divorce. And to be honest, it's even more. It's more like $150,000. And when my wife and I were talking about dividing assets, the big thing that I wanted was, you know, I'm not a kid. I'm not a spring chicken. I need to know that I've got money so I can buy a house and I can do. And I wanted her to have the house, which I felt was the right thing to do. But
you don't want to be working till you're 75 either.
Well, and I will be probably, but
but yeah, you don't want to.
I don't want to. That's for sure. But it was important that whatever we had, and we're not rich people by any stretch, but that whatever our assets were, they remained with us. They didn't go to pay off a lawyer, because that would be really dumb, in my opinion. And she was completely on board. And I'm happy to say we spent a little over $2,000. Like, that's not a lot of money at the end of the day when you stop and you think about it. So we did a great division of assets. We agreed basically on 95% of everything. And we even took a selfie the day we were in the lawyer's office, to commemorate the occasion. So, the good news is it has been amicable.
There's not a lot of selfies taken in divorce proceedings. I'll just say
not.
That.
There's not. And it's a big thing. And, you know, again, I didn't want it to be where, you know, mom and dad have this really strained relationship, and it affects the kids, because we both know that can occur. And that wasn't something that either of us also wanted, you know. And the kid said, you know, so part of it is too, my wife and I have been getting along better the last few months than we had for maybe the year prior. And, you know, my son especially said, well, why would you get a divorce now or separate now when you're getting along so well? And that was really the whole point of it, because we are getting along so well, because we don't see a reconciliation, but we can talk about this and do what's right, because we're not angry with each other. We can do what's right for the other person. So we did. We've made it happen. And, you know, it's been bizarre. I'm in the palatial studios of my brand new luxury apartment in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, recording for the first time. And it's been an interesting week. I signed the lease and I got what I wanted. I wanted a very large one bedroom with a den. And the den is so that, you know, the kids can sleep over. And I should say too, I did get Ozzy. Ozzy is with me. There is no way I would leave Oz. Mr. Noodles, not with me. Mr. Noodles, is at the other location. And just
do
as
you
I
have, said, do you have visitation with Mr. Noodles?
I do have it. And there's Ozzy. As I even say his name, he just walked over to me. I do have visitation. And, you know, it's like, even with the kids, there's no, you know, Zoe slept over two nights last week. She was here for 3 days. So we're just dividing her time as she feels comfortable, or as anyone feels comfortable. You know, none of this is written in stone in any form. And I don't think it has to be. You know, this might be the first truly amicable divorce in the history of divorces. And, you know, and I kid when I say that, Jeff, because obviously there are other divorces that have been amicable, but it's really important to me to address it today for all the reasons that I stated.
So, wow. First of all, I couldn't help but think of the old joke, you know, marriage, when I got married, I think it was like $85 was for the marriage license. And, you know, the old joke is, why is it so much more expensive to get divorced than it is to get married? And the old joke, of course, is because it's worth it. Okay, thank you. Ba-da-dum, boom, boom. But anyway, as you were telling the story, I recall that the first Mrs. Bowdrin, she who shall not be named, she, in fact, was a part-time cashier when I was an assistant manager at the lovely Toys R Us in Hollywood, Florida. Shout out to all my friends in Hollywood, Florida, the single mother capital of the United States, I've always said, because good Lord, every woman that worked at Toys R Us over the holiday season was a single mother. I have no idea why, but that was the statistics that I found. That was pretty interesting. You know, the second Mrs. Bowdrin and I, it was interesting because we had a lot of contention towards the end. You know, she, I will say she was dealing with the death of her father. And, you know, so, but I, before he even got sick, I was very unhappy. We had a lot of issues. One thing, you know, I have to say, and this is, I'm not directing this towards Barry. I'm directing it towards everybody. You know, one thing that people, I don't think, realize is that, you know, when you get married, one of the things that people don't realize that you need to be able to do is to have a good marital argument and like be able to know what is in bounds and what is out of bounds. You know, that thing that happened 8 months ago that you're still cheesed off about, you can't throw that at the other person. You know, if you're arguing about, oh, we spent, you know, $10 too much on groceries, or the phone bill's a little high this month, or whatever, you know, you can't sit there and go, oh, you know, you spent $10 too much on the groceries. And by the way, let me mention that 8 months ago, yada, yada, yada. No, you don't do that. You fight fair and you have civil arguments, you know. And, you know, Mrs. Bowdrin currently and I, we occasionally have discord. It happens in every relationship. And we've been together for going on. Ooh, wow. Barry, in May will be 22 months. We'll be together. And, you know,
22 years, Jeff.
I'm sorry. You're correct. It's a little faux pas there, but we'll be together 22 years and we almost never argue. And I'm incredibly blessed to say that we just don't have a lot of arguments, whether that's because, you know, she just gives in and I'm a friggin' idiot. It's probably a very good reason that, you know, there, but she's very accommodating that way. She doesn't, you know, I guess I could say she picks her spots more. And, you know, as you were going over your situation, I was thinking back to an occasion where Mrs. Bowdrin and I had been having, this is about 11 years ago. We were having some financial difficulties, let's just say. And Mrs. Bowdrin came to me and she told me, look, this is what's going on, blah, blah, blah. And I looked at her and I said, okay, here's where we kind of fish or cut bait. This is either going to end our marriage or it's going to make our marriage stronger. You tell me which one you want to do. And she said, I want our marriage to be stronger. And we got through it and we were strengthened by it. And, you know, it's, and the reason I say that is because so often there are people that, you know, they quit. That they quit rather than, you know, we talk about marital fights. Sometimes you have to fight for your marriage too, you know? And that was a case where we were both fighting for our marriage because we knew we had to get through those financial difficulties, fight for our marriage and fight for our relationship. And I'm happy I did. And, you know, Barry and I were talking on the phone the other night and I told him the story about how I've told Mrs. Bowdrin. I said, look, I said, if you intend to leave this mortal coil before I do, I will not know what the hell to do. Barry was talking about how he hasn't paid a bill in, what'd you say, 25 years or something, you know, because your wife handled that. And I haven't either. God knows if I tried to access our bank account, I would have no freaking idea right. How to do that, you know? And so I told her, I said, if you leave this mortal coil before I do, I'm going to come up and kick you right in the friggin' crotch because I won't have a clue what to freaking do. And that's on me, I guess. But, you know, that's the way it is. But, you know, marriage is it's like another job. And I told my daughter that before she got married. You need to look at this as a second job. And it's a job like any job. You need to work at it to be successful. And, you know, she and her husband right now, things are going good. I'm confident that within the next 20 to 25 years, they're going to hit a rough spot. And they'll have to work their way through it. It's what happens to every you know, married couple, every couple that's just living together in a relationship. And, you know, and if you're able to not work your way through it, if you can leave amicably, that's all the better, because, you know, who needs the aggravation? And certainly we know people that have had relationships end, and it's like, oh, that bitch, oh, that asshole, you know. And one of my very best friends, when she divorced her husband, they had a young son that was about 5 or 6 years old. And it's like, you're an asshole father. And I'd be like, don't say that to the kid. You don't want him to, you don't want to talk about his father that way any more than you'd want his father when he has visitation rights to, oh, your mother, that bitch. No, you don't do that to the kid. You don't put that on the kid. That's between you and your spouse or your former spouse. And that you and your wife were able to have this split and remain amicable and remain friends. I got to tell you, me and Mrs. Bowdren number two, you know, after we had gotten divorced, she called me up and she said, I got a speeding ticket. Do you know a lawyer that can help me? And I said, yes. And we went and had lunch. I took the ticket from her. I recommended a lawyer for her that helped her out in the situation. And I sat there and I thought to myself, wow, you know, if we'd got along this good, maybe we wouldn't have ended up getting married or getting divorced, you know. But one of the problems that we had throughout our marriage was we never communicated. Because if there was any sort of marital discord, she gave me the silent treatment, didn't speak to me for 2 or 3 days. And so guess what? 2 or 3 days later, she starts speaking to me, but we still never resolved the issue that caused her to give me the silent treatment to begin with. That's not a way to be married. That's not a way to be in a relationship. And it's a recipe for disaster. So, Barry, I'm glad that you are in a good place now. I'm not talking about Plymouth Meeting, by the way. I'm talking about emotionally. I'm glad that that Zach and Zoe are in good places. I'm glad, honestly, that Jennifer's in a good place, too. I, you know, had the occasion to meet her, and she seems a very nice woman, very nice person. And I certainly would not wish her any ill will at all either. So I'm happy that the Rose family is in a good place, and especially more than any of you, you know, Ozzy. As long as Ozzy's in a good place, that's what's important, Bear.
Yeah, Ozzy's licking himself right now, too, as you say that.
So and the old George Carlin line is, why do dogs lick themselves? Because they can.
They can. Definitely. Yeah, it is too. And you know, you, everything you just said, you made some great points right there. And you're Jeff, you'd be 100% right.
Check.
But it is, you know, this is, it's a learning, this is a learning time for me as well, because, you know, as things start to pop up, like things like dating, well, you know, I've been out in the dating game for 25 years. You know, you mentioned the bills and you and I were talking about that off air. You know, when I used to pay bills when I was younger, it was I would get a check and I would put it in an envelope, get a stamp and mail it. Things have changed. So, you know, getting a handle on all that has been changed. But the end result, you know, if we're looking, communication, as you said, absolutely. Communication is key with any relationship, whether it's an intimate relationship or otherwise. But we're just very different people who grew apart and leading very different lives. And you said something to me months ago, and this was something that Jennifer and I discussed, but you said to me, was you wanting to move to Florida part of the reason for this? And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't with an asterisk at the end of the day, is, you know, it's probably the best way to put it. She is from this area. Her parents, who are both great people and still alive, are from this area. And at some point, you know, my heart is in Florida. There's no two ways about it. And if I could move today, and I should say, too, the reason I'm not moving is because Zoe is still in high school. And when Zoe graduates next year is when I do move to Florida. And I have a 15-month lease on this apartment. And when this lease expires, I should be in the state of Florida. But we would have crossed this road, my wife and I would have crossed this road when Zoe was out of school, when Zoe was going off to college, because I did not want to, you know, it snowed again today, Jeff. Another fucking snowstorm today. We had one 5 days ago. We had one a week ago. You know, this is a really, really horrible winter so far. And I don't want to do this any longer. And you know, this is not an area that I want to be in. So we were facing something in a year and a half, but that really wasn't the issue at this moment. It would have been the issue in a year and a half, no doubt, but it certainly wasn't now. It's just a case of two people who have grown apart who are very different. And that's all it is. And that's why, You know, that's why everything has been amicable. She's a great person. You know, it's I wish her nothing, but she's entitled. She deserves everything great that could ever come in her way and for the rest of her life. And that's, you know, and I say that with all honesty and all sincerity.
So just to close this portion of the show out on a slightly humorous note, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that Mrs. Rose, or the soon-to-be ex-Mrs. Rose, will not be available to any members of the group that may want to reach out to her for dating purposes.
well, let's...
that'd be a no.
Yeah, let's say I'm not necessarily really against that if somebody would make her happy, but I will tell you, I think she...
Dave Flaherty, come on down!
I think... she would sooner never date again than to date somebody who's a wrestling fan. So I got to put that one out there.
Phil, yeah. Let's just say that. Yes. I have dated a few women that do not want to date anyone having to do anything with pro wrestling.
Oh, it's
funny how that works out, isn't it?
It's funny. Yes.
So, you know, Barry, on our delightful Facebook page, Breaking Kayfabe with Badrin and Barry, we recently ran a contest. We said instead of a match of the week, Barry, we're going to have an angle of the week. And we put about six angles up there. And one of the angles we put up there was Bob Armstrong, the Bullet, who we recently lost, unfortunately, turned heel on the Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller. So I reached out to Ron Fuller and I said, Ron, you know, strictly because I need to know the date of this angle, if you have it, or if you can give me, if not the exact date, the month and the year. So we get a little specific when Barry and I talk about the angle. And then lo and behold, the Tennessee stud himself gets back with me, because we talk in text more than people know, Barry. I'm gonna admit that to you.
Right.
And he says, I will come on your show, the Peabody Award winning, by the way, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, and discuss this angle in detail. Barry, we are joined by our friend, the Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller. Ron, how you doing, my man?
Oh, I'm great, Jeff. And how are you doing, man? It's really nice to hear your voice again. No?
Well, I'm doing well. I appreciate you asking. You know, my wife says she likes to hear my voice too, you know, but that's another story for another
time. That's a good sign. That's always a good thing.
So Ron, we have started talking, you know, we had our contest for the, like I said, the angle of the week, and the good folks on our Facebook group, they voted in mass, I might add, for the angle where Bob Armstrong turned heel on you, the Tennessee, as if it turned heel on you, the Tennessee stud. And the date we're talking about, we're talking October 26, 1982. And before I go to Barry for his reaction, we're going to get a little background on it, Barry, as Ron's going to tell us what led up to the events of that night when the Bullet Bob Armstrong, for the first time in his career, turned on the fans and he turned on his friend Ron Fuller. So, Ron, why don't you give us a little background, my man?
Okay. I want to just jump back to 1978. Southeastern started down there in Pensacola and the old Gulf Coast territory that I had bought. And I started out there as a heel. Bob Armstrong was the top babyface for the first 6 or 7 months that we ran that company. When it was really dead, we built it up to big business. And I was the heel. He was the babyface. And then I turned babyface in that territory. We rode along there for almost 3 years with both of us being baby faces. And so this world championship match is coming up on in October 26, 1982. And so we have a tournament, which is kind of a thing that we used to do quite a bit of in Southeastern. And the tournament it finals ends up being two baby faces, me against Bob Armstrong. The winner the next week is going to wrestle Flair for the title. So I squeeze through and I win this match. Okay. So the next week we go into Mobile. We were usually running the expo hall, held about 5,000 people. We moved in the auditorium. We drew 10,000 plus this night on October the 26th, I remember it being in late 1982. Pretty much filled up a big, big, beautiful Coliseum that was there at the old Mobile Auditorium. And so in this match, once I win this match over Bob, he comes on TV with me when I'm ready to publicize and ready to do an interview for this match with Flair. And he says, Ron, we've been friends for years and years now. You know, he goes, I just want to be, I know you're going to win the world title. I know you're going to win it with that toe hold. You beat me with it in Mobile last week. I want to be the referee. Just can would you mind? Can you ask? Can we get it done? And we started calling into St. Louis, and before the TV show was over, Bob Armstrong was going to be the special referee. So I go out there against Ric Flair, Bob Armstrong, special referee. I mean, Bob's referee in the match, fair and square, right down the line. We get in probably 30, 45 minutes into the match. I get a big comeback going on Flair. Flair's had me in the figure four. I've been able to reverse it. Bob still just right square up down the middle, you know, and actually maybe kind of on my side in the early portions of this match. And then we get down to the final area where I reverse Flair's figure four, and Armstrong, you know, he obviously he's asking Flair if he wants to give up. Flair drags himself over to the ropes enough that Bob breaks the hold. And when he breaks the hold, you know, I'm pretty hurt too. I mean, you can't do that. You can't reverse that hold. You get in that hold, and even when you reverse it, you're still in pain. But I was able to reverse it. So I was having a hard time getting to my feet, and Flair gets up just before I do. He picks me up to slam me. I drop down behind him, and I put my toe hold on him. Never in my entire career had anybody ever failed to give up in that hold. I was basically the world heavyweight champion at that instant, you know, and Bob knew it. And so Bob, we're both on our backs. The way that I do that toe hold, Flair and I are both on our backs. I've got his leg, and he's hurting. And so Bob is coming to me, and he's saying he hasn't give up, and he'd go back to Flair's face, and Flair would say no, and I could see Bob back and forth. And then, as I said, as Flair starts to...
I think that's Robert Fuller on the phone. trying to get in on this, you know.
I'll just pick it up from right there. I was waiting on it to stop. So as Flair is about to give up, Bob comes back to me, and instead of telling me yes, that it's over, that you've won, he starts dropping elbows on me. And I'm in a very, very vulnerable position. I can't move. I can't get my legs unlocked from Flair's legs. And Bob starts with the elbows, and it goes from the elbows until Flair finally is able to get to his feet. And then they both start working on my knees. I had bad knees starting early 81, a couple of surgeries in 80, one in 80, one in 81. And so they started working on my bad knees, and that crowd went crazy when Bob dropped those first elbows, and they realized that Bob is doing something that they never expected him to do. It was silence for probably the first 30, 45 seconds of them both having their way with me. And then I started bleeding. And all of a sudden, that crowd exploded. Mobile was a very dangerous town. I was arrested the first night I worked there in 1978 as a heel. So I know how bad it was. And when that started, the crowd started coming to the ring. They were doing things like Flair was holding my leg, and Bob would get on the top rope, and he would jump off across my leg. You know, the fans just were rabid. They were about to start into the ring, and then baby faces started coming from the dressing room to help me. Austin Idol got thrown over the top rope when he came. My brother came. Jimmy Golden came. I mean, they just kept coming. And Bob or Flair would stop them as soon as they got to the apron and trot them right across the ring and throw them right out into the crowd. And at this point, the crowd was all at the ring. They weren't back in their seats anymore. And I remember Bob and Flair having a very, very difficult time in getting to the dressing room. They, you know, and so what happened in that event is, with Bob turning heel, and I was babyface, obviously, pretty darn over at that point too. Bob had Brad, who was already started. He had Scott and Steve, his other boys, in the gym. They were going to be wrestling within the next 2 years or less. And it just created for Southeastern, that territory at that time, the greatest feud in the history of that territory. And, it blew up overnight. Bob went on. I actually, the next show afterward, I went back because I messed my knee up again, and I had to go back and get an arthroscopic on the knee. And I went back to Dothan on TV, and I retired. I took my boots. I put them on the ring. I had Charlie Platt in the building. It was totally empty. I hung my robes on the ropes, and I said, "Charlie, I'm through. I mean, I've never had anything like this happen to me before." And I walked away. I walked away from the sport. Bob became the ultimate heel. He not only was a great heel, he was an unbelievable heel, maybe a better heel than he was as a babyface. And that territory just it exploded. I mean, business was the best in 1983 in the history of that company, and Bob was a heel most of that year. And then eventually, 6 months later, Bob does everything. He grows a mustache. He starts smoking cigarettes on energy. I mean, he takes it to the extreme.
No, Ron, I don't mean to interrupt, but when you just said that, one of the notes I'd made was the whole smoking on TV. I've mentioned this on our show before, that when Bob turned and started doing the bit where he would smoke cigarettes, my brother doesn't even watch wrestling, but he happened to be turning the channel once and he saw Bob doing an interview where he was smoking the cigarettes. My brother, who's 7 years older than me, he calls me up because I don't know what in the heck is going on, but Bob Armstrong's on TV smoking cigarettes. And so even the casual fan who was turning in and swinging by on the channels, he observed that and he saw the kind of stuff Bob was doing. I interrupted. Please continue.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, you know, he took it to another level. You know, he'd been married for many years and people really knew Bob was a great straight guy as far as, you know, his marriage was concerned. It was important to him. All of a sudden, he had a girlfriend. Her name was Fannie Mae Titwiler. And he would come on and say, and he would show these gifts. "Look at this watch Fannie Mae bought for me, man. She loves me. I love my Fannie Mae." I mean, he just was phenomenal as a heel. And so he actually, we had a match in which Brad was wrestling on TV against Ricky Gibson, who was another good babyface match. Ricky Gibson hurt his leg and Brad wouldn't pin him. Brad refused to pin him, refused to take the match. And Bob came into the ring and argued with Brad about it and finally slapped Brad on TV. Brad got out of the ring and left. And then Bob went ahead and started working on Ricky's hurt knee and putting the boots to him. I mean, they just did some phenomenal stuff. Then Bob finally slapped the commentator, Charlie Platt, and this was about 6 months after I had retired, maybe 7 months, middle of the summer, and business was just already phenomenal. And Charlie Platt, the next week after he got slapped, he confronted Bob. He said, "I want you to come here." He goes, "You know, you shouldn't have done that to me last week." And it was a lot of heat. In fact, there were some National Guardsmen that called Charlie Platt up and said, "Where is he? We're going to get him for you, Charlie. We're going to get Bob Armstrong." Everybody was really into it. And then so Charlie sits Bob down at the desk and he says, "Somebody that you hate is come back. I've talked to him." And he just reached down and underneath the set, he had my wrestling boots, and he just lifted the boots up and set them on the set, and that crowd popped, and boy, business rocked from there, man. It was unbelievable. And then it developed into, it went all kinds of directions. And eventually, Bob turns back babyface. I need help. I'm trying to beat the Harns and Stubb, and I've got Andre as a partner and all these people I'm bringing in. And Bob is saying, I want to be your partner, Ron. I'm so sorry about what I did. I got to repay you. You got to let me do it. And I kept going, no way, no way, no way. And then finally he came and had to save me. And we went back to being babyface. And then probably 6-8 months later, I turned heel on him. So that started the Stud Stable. Business is just phenomenal for 5 years.
All right. So Barry, since we have the man here himself to talk about the program and the angle, you got any questions for the Stud about this?
I got a lot of questions for the Stud. So you did answer, first and foremost, I guess, was the knee injuries, because when Bob's doing the interview, he's talking about that you had two previous knee surgeries, but they really do work over your knee. Did you feel anything? I mean, I realize that, you know, Bob Armstrong was arguably one of the great professional wrestlers of all time, but as I'm watching it, I'm actually grabbing my knee because it looks painful. Did you feel anything that night?
Yes.
On your knee?
Yes, you know, and that wasn't uncommon, and I never blamed anybody for it. But boy, when you get into a finish like that, and you've got all that happening, and you see those people with their stomachs up to the ring, and the police are fighting them to try to get them back, and you know, Bob at one point there, he really ripped me a knee problem again. You know, I mean, it was well worth it. In the long run, it was well worth it, because whenever I watch that match back, I cringe myself. I know the spot in which it happened, and I'm like, oh, there it is. Oh, wow. You know, I did get my knee hurt again. And I had arthroscopic surgery. In fact, 2 days later with William Andrews in Birmingham.
Oh, wow.
One of the best orthopedics in the world. You know, it was a legit, parts of that were really legit. I was legitimately hurt. And those guys, they were lucky to get out of that building. They really, I don't know how they got out of that after it was all over, but you know, that crowd was just really, really crazy wild.
Yeah. I have to say, excuse me, Barry, that one of the things I thought was really funny was, well, I also saw an interview that Bob had done. And this might have been a while afterwards, because he'd already grown out the mustache and stuff. And he was reflecting back upon the angle. And he was sitting at the desk with Jody Hamilton, who was there as the Flame. And he says, you know, I want you folks to know that I did Ron Fuller a favor. That boy needed arthroscopic surgery. So I just helped him out. That's all I did.
Oh, he was great. Just a phenomenal heel when he did that deal. I mean, he was, I watched it. I sat home and watched it, obviously, every TV. You know, to keep up with what was going on. And it was just, wow. I was just like, wow, he's just phenomenal, man. I hated him too. I'm sure the fans did. I got to hating him myself.
Yeah, that, and the mustache too was a definite heel mustache when you look at it, because even as I'm watching it, I'm like, man, that is just, that's one ugly mustache, actually. you know, you can really see it. But I think my next is, it's more of a comment, but we've discussed some of the great punchers in professional wrestling, guys that can throw an amazing punch. And, you know, Jerry Lawler's name comes up, Bob Cook, that name has come up. But I got to tell you, I'm watching Ron just throw these haymakers on Flair, and I'm just like, wow, you threw a fantastic punch, Ron.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I had those long arms, and once I figured out how to buggy whip them, as that's what the guys used to say. Well, they called it the old wraparound. They called my punch the wraparound. Then the story was that it's going to hit you on both sides of the head at the same time. So, you know, it kind of wrapped around the back of their head. And, you know, guys didn't much like it. It was a little bit stiff, but you know, it looked pretty darn good. Well, in fact, it was a little stiff, and no wonder it looked pretty good. I would have hated to have somebody doing it to me, to be honest with you.
You know, Ron, that reminds me, of course, of a famous story that Mick Foley told about watching Terry Funk as a wrestling fan. He goes, you know, I used to think Terry Funk threw the greatest looking punches I'd ever seen in pro wrestling. He goes, and then I had a match with him, and I found out why they look so great, because they weren't worked.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, you know, so yeah, if you're willing to go ahead and make it hurt a little bit, you're probably going to have a pretty decent looking punch. That's for sure.
Yeah. So let me just, as far as going back to the genesis of the whole idea of the thing, how far before you actually did the angle in October of 82, when did you first start developing the germ of the idea? Was it you and Bob? Was it just Bob? Was it just you? Who came up with the idea for this?
Bob and I were booking together, kind of. And we were spending time, obviously we were both baby faces at the time. So we were making trips together, and on the way home, we just discussed what do we do next and how do we get people? How do we freak them out? Do something they just can't believe. And then, one night, I think I said, why don't you turn heel? And he was like, whoa, gosh, you know, I never thought about that, Ron. You know, I said, you've never done it. You've never healed, right? I mean, I said, you want to freak them out? You want to have everybody just going, this is unbelievable. How could this happen? So, you know, we about probably 3 months ahead of time, we kind of knew we were headed that direction. I also was having the knee problems. Like I was saying, I'd had knee problems for 2 years, and I wanted to take some time off. So, you know, it was a perfect fit. I said, well, Bob, you do me in. You and Flair do me in on the championship match, and then I'll be out. I can take a rest, and then when you're really hot in the summer, I'll come back. And that whole thing worked so great because eventually once the stud stable got up and I was running Rob and Jimmy and Arn Anderson and Jerry Stubbs and the Assassin, and I just had a troop of heels that I was constantly bombarding Bob, you know, just constantly after Bob Armstrong and then his boys. Brad was a tremendous worker. Brad's involved, and along came Scott, along came Steve, my brother and Jimmy Golan, and it was like family versus family, and it just seemed like it didn't stop for 5 years. It was just back and forth for 5 years, phenomenal business during that entire time frame.
I think one of the things, too, that I like about this angle, and I think what actually, at least my eyes, what makes it work is the inclusion of the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion, Ric Flair. So how does that go? Just, and this is, I guess, where, you know, we want to understand the booking and maybe the conversations around it, but you've actually got the world champion coming in, and he's part of arguably the biggest angle in the history of this entire promotion. What kind of conversation is that?
We didn't talk to him prior to his arrival, but I had spoke to Sam about it, Sam Muchnick, and I told Sam what we wanted to do. You know, I kind of felt like this is really maybe putting a champion in a place that they might not want him to be. But Sam saw it. He captured the concept right away, and he's like, God, Ron, goes, wow, you're gonna light your territory up. I said, well, I hope so, Sam, you know. But anyway, Flair and I and Bob sat down in the dressing room in Mobile probably an hour before the match, and Bob says, okay, Ron, how do you want to do it? And Flair looked at him like, what are y'all talking about? How are you going to do what? And I laid out the finish. And Rick looked at Bob. He kept looking at Bob while I'm talking about it, you know, like checking him out, like, damn, are you hearing this? And then at the end of the conversation, I said to Rick, I said, what do you think? And he says, I think we're going to get killed, Ron. I'll never forget it. It's like, oh my. And for an hour before, you know, probably 2 hours before we actually went to the ring, he was pacing the floors, and he came two or three times, Ron, are you sure? Are you sure you want to do this? Yeah, Rick, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. And, yeah, so it was good. It was good just seeing his face and that line. You know, we're going to get killed, Ron. I mean, I'll never forget that line. It was good.
So let me ask you, you chose the town of Mobile to do the angle in and to have the world title match. Now, I know you had other other, you know, towns, you know, you have Pensacola, you have Birmingham, you had Dothan. Was Mobile obviously the selected because it was the, you know, your biggest market? That's where you had the biggest crowds, or why did you pick Mobile as opposed to the other towns?
Mobile was a tremendous wrestling town. All the way back to 1958 when my dad wrestled Mario Galento there in Ladd Stadium with 40,000 people. 40,000 people in Ladd Stadium, 1958. And it was the biggest building in our territory. It had two buildings in that complex there, the Expo Hall that had about 5,000 seats. And then right next to it was this big, round, beautiful auditorium that were probably about 14,000 seats. And, you know, so Bob and I talked and said, this is a Mobile angle. It's the only building that we can get all the people we need to get in there to see it live. So, and that's kind of how Mobile got chosen, because they had the biggest building in the territory.
Yeah. And, you know, there's no question. If you watch the video, one of the things I really liked about the angle is when you have Flair in the hold and then Bob starts dropping the elbows on you, you can see that the people at ringside are just kind of sitting there like they're kind of stunned. And then when he really starts working you over, like all of a sudden they just all rise up and start going towards the ring. But that initial being stunned by what they saw was part of what made the angle so great.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, when you're in a match like that and you know the spot is coming, you know, that's going to tell you right there that that they bought it. I mean, when he started dropping those elbows and their silence came in that building, I knew that, oh, wow, we got them. We got them. Yeah. You know, and that's a great feeling when you're a wrestler and in the ring and you know what's coming. That, you know, we've got them, and now I'm glad I'm not the heel. You know, I'm glad that you guys got to worry about getting back to the dressing room. You know, right. So it's an easy game for me here on, and you guys, good luck. So
I got one last question about the angle for you, Ron. Tell me the importance in getting the angle over after that night when you come back and you're shooting your TV. And when I started the angle the version of the angle I saw was your brother Robert comes out to the set and Charlie Platt is there. And, you know, Charlie is approaching it. He's taking a very solemn approach to it. And your brother is also very low. He's not like, I'm going to go out there and whoop up. You know, he's very like Bob Armstrong knew what he did and he knows what's coming towards him. So tell me the importance of having an announcer like Charlie Platt getting the angle over afterwards to the fans.
Oh, it's extremely important. That first week, when you turn a heel, you want to make sure everything is just perfect, and it worked out well. He's my brother; he had watched it. In fact, he watched it with Charlie Platt at the set, and he was like, "Oh my!" You know, he never blew up, but you could just see. And I think we even had some split screen. You know, where you could see him on one part of the screen and you could see the match progressing on the other side. And he sold it really good. And then also he went out there and did a tremendous job for Bob, being my brother. And Bob just slaughtered him, man. Bob just drove that heat right down the fans' throats. And gosh, that's what you got to do when you switch a big time baby face to heel. You got to hammer that heat, man, and it worked for us. They did a great job. Bob did a great job. My brother did a great job. And boy, we threw the baby faces at Bob. We gave him some great baby faces. We had great baby faces in the territory, and he conquered them all. He just got hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter till I came back.
So. All right. Well, Ron, listen, we certainly appreciate you joining us here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, talking about this all-time classic angle. We will, of course, post a link on our Facebook page. I think the fans are really going to get a big kick out of it. I know, Ron, that I speak for Barry when I say thank you so much for joining us. And Ron, of course, Barry, we have to remember, best-selling author.
Yeah, absolutely, too. He's a this is New York Times best-selling author, if I'm correct, right?
We're lucky to even have him.
Oh, guys. Well, geez, man, I appreciate that plug, but you know, I ended up an author. I'm not so sure how I ended up an author, but I did.
Why don't you mention for the folks where they can get your book, Brutus?
Yeah, you can they get it at Amazon.com. Just put in the word Brutus and novel, and you can get it there. Or you can get it off of my website at tnstud.com. Just click on the stud store, and you can get an autographed copy. I can send you an autographed copy of the book, and you can't get that through Amazon. You can only get that through the website at TN Stud. But it's a book's doing very, very well. I'm getting all these people saying it's the next Jaws. So they're putting me in pretty good company there with that book and movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, once again, Ron, we certainly appreciate you joining us. And so on behalf of Lou and Barry, we really appreciate it, and have a good one, my brother.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, guys.
Okay. So the next angle we want to talk about, Barry. Oh, as I said, we're in Jacksonville, where both my folks and my sister live. And back on April 20th of 1988, the Horsemen were joined by Barry Windham. You've had a chance to watch this angle. And I got to tell you, Barry, I hadn't seen this angle in a long time. This is a really well done, effective angle.
Oh, it's fantastic too. And the funny thing is, this is one of those angles where I can tell you where I was at the time that I saw it. I was at a girlfriend's house, much like John McAdam, right? I was at a girlfriend. That's a second.
I wasn't even going to say that.
It's like a given at this point.
Yeah. What was her name? And
her name. And I haven't seen her in years. And I was going to take her to the prom. Yeah. But anyways, I was at a girlfriend's house who was casually into wrestling at the time with me. And what I liked about this, first off, I wasn't in my home environment, so I was kind of, maybe talking or doing other things, but this caught me completely by surprise. And I think first off, my favorite type of angle in professional wrestling is always going to be a turn. And it's usually a heel turn. Heel turn's better than a baby face turn. And this one, I did not see coming. Some people will say, I saw the hints, and certainly they allude to it with Ric Flair during the interview segment of this, but I didn't see it coming. And, my God, Barry Windham was just tremendous. There's that whole period, we've talked about it, 85 through 88, 89. There was just nobody better than Barry Windham. So he was tremendous. This angle was tremendous. J.J. Dillon and explaining the whole situation was just absolutely fantastic. And even Luger, it was basically it's Windham turning on Luger and joining the Horsemen. Even Luger played his part, absolutely correct. So
I will say, since sure. I have put the boots to Lex Luger on this program before, you are spot on. Barry, you are 100% correct, my man.
Check.
Thank you. And because he is excellent in this, he does a very good interview after the turn. His role and the post-turn angle that they do involving Dusty and Barry, where he comes in to Dusty's rescue, he was also very effective in that also. So props to Lex Luger. At this point, he was doing some solid work.
Yeah, he definitely was too. And we could talk about Luger forever. And the shame of Luger was not seeing, I think, the bigger picture in seeing only Luger, because he should have been a bigger star. He should have been a much bigger star. And I definitely feel that Luger held himself back by some of his behaviors, but he did everything right here. The real star, Windham is the real star here. J.J. Dillon has got to get a lot of credit. And how cool, Jeff, as I was watching J.J. and Windham talk, that, the last fan fest we had, which is a year and 4 months ago, it was headlined by J.J. and Windham. That these two guys who are still very good friends sitting next to each other actually discussing this angle as well. So
was Dave Pinzer the moderator of that event?
I think you were, weren't you?
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, okay. I think you were. I would say this is one of my favorite turns of all time. And I really like, too, It doesn't make much sense, but I really like where the Midnight Rider actually goes into the Heel dressing room demanding an explanation from Wyndham. Don't turn your back on me. Don't walk away from me. And then gets jumped by like 30 heels in the dressing room. And then they drag him out. So I would say this is probably in my top 10 turns of all time.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, just to double back to what you talked about, the Midnight Rider going into the dressing room to confront the heels. Did you notice, and for those of you that hadn't seen this, we'll post a link to this, watch when he goes into the dressing room as he's confronting Barry Windham, he reaches back and begins untying the mask.
Right.
Which I thought was really funny. And then as he's down on the ground, J.J. Dillon's going, get the mask, get the mask. And, it was actually kind of funny to see Kevin Sullivan, who had such a long history with Dusty in there, almost like as an afterthought, which is, a little sad for fans of Florida to see. A couple other things. The fact that Barry unleashes the claw, and this was something, of course, his dad, Blackjack Mulligan, used the claw, but Barry Windham, I don't recall, maybe in Mid-Atlantic when he was Blackjack Mulligan Jr., he had, but as Barry Windham, never used the claw. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think he'd ever used the claw prior to this. Here's the other thing, too. Barry had never been a heel before this, right?
No.
Right, because at one point there's some sort of comment made, and I think it might be Flair, where he says, oh, Barry Windham, he said something where he kind of alluded to the fact that Barry had been a heel before, and I don't recall that ever happening. But no, he never used the claw before.
Yeah, and a very subtle comment by, I think it was Jim Ross. Real early into the clip, Luger gets thrown out onto the arena floor, and Windham is there, standing over him, protecting him and stuff like that. And Jim Ross makes a comment. He says, Barry Windham is, he's guarding his friend Lex Luger. They're, of course, best friends inside and out of the ring. Right there, you're getting the ball ready to be lobbed for to get hit out of the park. Just a little subtle inference there. I thought it was pretty well done. So here's the only argument that I had, and this is something that Barry and I talked about before we started recording. The fact that when the angle was done, obviously Dusty was still the booker at this point. Dusty making himself the focal point of the angle. Now, of course, it was very well established that Dusty and Barry almost had a parent-child relationship was the way that it was almost presented. But Barry Long had been a protege of Dusty's and stuff like that. So from that point of view, I get the fact that Dusty was made the focal point of the angle, but he turned on Luger. And of course, JJ was in the corner yelling to Barry Windham, I told you he wouldn't be there when you needed him. And because Lex Luger had been knocked down off the apron, but would this have enhanced Lex Luger more if Dusty had bitten the bullet and let Lex take the ball and run with it and make Lex the focal point of the angle? In other words, have Lex Luger be the guy that goes into the dressing room instead of Dusty.
That's a big if too. So if Lex had a flaw, it would have been charisma, and it would have been, Dusty had a way, whatever his limitations were at this stage of his career, he did have a way of connecting with the crowd. I do think the history, because as you just said, it really was almost a father-son type of relationship. Dusty, especially when they were in Florida, it was Dusty and Windham, all the time. It wasn't even Blackjack, who wasn't even working in Florida at that stage. So I think it had to be Dusty to be more effective. But with that being said, they should have done more with the Dusty Luger team. And had you done more, I think it would have been a little more effective that way.
Yeah. So once again, we will post a link on our Facebook page, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. This is an angle. It's a good 20 minutes, because not only do they have the angle, they have the aftermath where Dusty goes into the heel dressing room. They have the Luger angle. Then they have the angle where Dusty calls out Barry Windham. Barry Windham is out there. They have a schmoz where Luger ends up getting involved in the schmoz along with the Horsemen. And very well done. And, I think the promotion had really started going downhill at this point. Dusty had kind of started running out of ideas, but giving props where it was due. This was fantastic in the way that it was done and executed. As far, I always talk about the best executed angle of all time, not the one that made the most money, But the, as far as just from an execution standpoint, I always say that DiBiase and Flair with Murdoch is the gold standard. But this one, if you watch it, wow, there's not much wrong you can find with this angle. It is well done by everybody involved. And so props to everybody involved there.
Yeah, no, and there's nothing else I can say. You're right. It's it was super well done. And I think this is, if you were to look at the current landscape of professional wrestling in the U.S., and there are turns that occur, obviously, there's no impact. And we discussed the turn in AEW of this guy, Powerhouse Will Hobbs. And my point was, because people weren't vested in him, that turn almost had no impact. And somebody actually shot me a message and said, oh, you're wrong about that. This guy's going to be something. He's going to be, but you know, here we are now, 2 months later, 3 months later, whatever it's been. And, you know, he's still on the back burner, and rightly so, because he doesn't have a ton of experience, but I do feel, and that's another thing too. You know, you're basically taking a guy that's had, you know, enough matches, maybe 5 matches, maybe 10, and you're turning him. Like, where's the logic with that? You know, back here, Wyndham, we loved Wyndham. And when I say we, I mean, you know, anybody watching NWA, he was one of the most popular wrestlers by far. So him turning really made you mad, which really makes this all so much more important.
Well, and just
think about it.
Just using your example, the angle on this took place in April 20th. Okay. They did a callback to an interview that Flair did Christmas time. So they let this marinate for 5 months. So imagine, if you will, just using the example that you use of Will Hobbs, okay? You have Taz come out and say, we're really interested in this guy. He's a hell of an athlete, and we would like him to join Team Taz. And the guy says, look, I got a lot of respect for you, but no, I'm not interested. And, you know, Taz is kind of PO'd, and they let that marinate for even 3 or 4 months. Good Lord, people. This is in Memphis. You don't have to do an angle every single week. Let shit marinate for a while. Then maybe you're talking, oh, I don't know, April or May, and Taz does a callback to that. And then after the guys had some time with the baby faces, you have them turn on somebody. And, you know, don't have them turn just for the sake of turning. Have them turn on Sting or somebody like that, or John Moxley, somebody that means something, you know, and really so that it has some sort of impact. God forbid they should, you know, Memphis was known for doing hotshot angles every single week. Some of them worked, some of them shit the bed, but they did enough of them where if they worked, they took it and ran with it. God bless them. They don't have to do that in AEW. And I wish they would let shit marinate for a little bit, Barry.
Yeah, and that's it. When you do let the shit marinate, you get a bigger payoff at the end. And that's the problem, too, is we don't see that. You know, the greatest angles to me, look at the Ernie Ladd turn, which I've talked about, you know, to great lengths. The Ernie Ladd turn on Dusty Rhodes in the state of Florida was something that everybody saw coming. And by the time it finally happened, people were just up in arms because it took 3 weeks to a month. There were these little hints being laid out every week. We all knew it was going to happen. We didn't know what city it was going to happen in, and luckily it was Miami. But again, when you rush these angles, when you rush any of this, there's no impact being made. So why even do it? Why do an angle if it's not going to have an impact? That makes no sense.
Yeah, no, I totally get you. So now, Barry, let us discuss the recent show on Netflix. You had a chance to watch it yet, my man?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. The recent show on Netflix called Crime Scene, The Cecil Hotel. Barry, you had a chance to watch this. I had mentioned to you earlier that I had seen it. What did you think of the show, my man?
So there were things about the show that I liked, which we can talk about. It's a compelling story. It is The Cecil Hotel, which I believe was the backdrop for the American Horror Story season, which was called Hotel. It's basically a murder hotel. Richard Ramirez lived here. There have been multiple killings, murders, overdoses, suicides, prostitution, drugs, you name it. If it's seedy in any form, it's taken place at this hotel. And I thought the backdrop was great. The focus of the series was Elisa Lam, which you discussed in one of the early episodes of Breaking Kayfabe when we're doing the Unsolved Mysteries. And it's about Elisa Lam, who is the young lady from Vancouver, British Columbia, that wound up in the water tower. What I liked about it was there were a lot of new facts that I don't think had ever been discussed previously. I know when we were talking, we both reviewed facts that were available online, and some of this stuff was not out there. You know, how she actually got in the water tower is completely different than what was being reported. And that's a little frightening in some ways. I can tell you, I did, and you said this, which unfortunately now, once you said it, I couldn't get it out of my head, but the show could have been 2.5 episodes, and it probably should have been 3 episodes, but you did not need to have the web sleuths, the amateur internet web sleuths, because it offered nothing, and it just showed you a subculture of incredibly lonely people that are looking to glom onto something and come up with their own hypotheses, much like we do when we do the unsolved mysteries. But we also realize our place. We also realize, you know, this is what I think. It doesn't make it right in any form. But a lot of these people truly believe that they've been able to solve this crime. And by doing so, they've also ruined lives. And you said there's this metal guy named Morbid, who is a guy that is a heavy metal musician from Mexico. And I use the word musician kind of because, you know, it's not really music.
Loose interpretation of the word.
Very, very loose. But at the same time, they've got this guy pegged as the killer. Turns out this guy hadn't even been in the hotel for over a year. But all this shit's online, and this essentially ruined his career. He's, you know,
ruined
all of his
life for a while.
Ruined his life.
His career, yeah.
Everything just taken
despicable,
off of YouTube.
Despicable what they did to the guy.
Yeah, because they didn't bother to do any research. They watched a video that he made, which has him hunting down a woman, and determined that, you know, look, the guy's making a movie, essentially, but that because he's been hunting down this woman, he must be the killer. And because he sings of things like blood and death, et cetera, that he must be the killer. It's ridiculous. But
he's, of course, the only metal and or death metal artist that does that, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's not like
touch of sarcasm there.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like every other one. So they could have done without that. What I think that they should have done is they should have explored the other things that have happened. You know, Richard Ramirez, just a brief time spent on him. There was a serial killer that came over from Europe, Germany, if I'm correct, Jeff.
Oh, yeah, that guy was pretty. Yeah, that was pretty wild.
That guy was unbelievable. And then as it turns out, they were able to, I guess, tie him into 3 or 4 murders in the. So he was essentially a serial killer who came over to this country, staying at the Cecil Hotel under the guise of being some sort of reporter or journalist and winds up killing.
He does ride-alongs with cops.
Yeah.
So he can find out where the whores are.
Yeah. And then the sad
thing. The cops are helping this guy find a potential victim.
Yeah. But the sad thing is because this hotel is right on Skid Row. And I think they said like there's 10,000 people that are homeless living in this area. There's no telling how many women this serial killer may have killed. I think they only mentioned 2 or 3, if I'm correct. But that would have been a really interesting story. And you could have completely done away with the internet web sleuths. They spent a lot of time interviewing the general manager of this Cecil Hotel. And I don't know. I didn't feel that she was overly compelling in anything that she was saying. She didn't offer anything. It was great that they could have her. But at the same time,
I think you're right. I think she should have had some time on there. The bit with them following her around the hotel as she's doing her rounds, we didn't need that. Quite frankly, for a far less amount of airtime, the Hispanic guy that was working there, that was the one that found the body, they could have given him more airtime because he had more to say.
Yeah, and that you're right. And that's exactly what they should have done. The Elisa Lam thing, too, it's a really tragic story. And I think this would be the crux of what was important about the show was the uncovering of a lot of new facts. And this is what stuck out in my head above everything else. When you presented this story to us, there was where she had gone in and lifted the cover of the water tower and then climbed in and then died. And You had researched that fact. I had gone online and researched that fact. Turns out there was another way to get in the water tower that anybody could get in. Had nothing to do with removing this cover, which I forget was like 100 pounds or something. It was some ridiculous number that we said that this young girl could have never done. Somebody had to have murdered her. Of course, all the facts weren't available, but as it turns out, spoiler alert, she had a very serious mental illness, and it looks
she was
like
on very serious medication too.
Or not taking the medication, yeah. Which was also part of the issue. And it's actually extremely tragic because if you ever wanted to see something sad, you just have to look at her mother's face.
Yeah, and no, that was really it devastating.
Was. Yeah, it really was.
Yeah, so. But anyway, so let's move on to some other topics, not quite as horrible as that. Barry, it's time for Florida Man or Not. Are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
No, I'm throwing them at you.
All right. I've got bring one it on.
You. Are you ready, mister?
I am.
Barry, the mayor, police chief, city clerk, what? And a former city clerk of a town have all been charged following a multi-year investigation that accuses them of misappropriating city funds, producing fraudulent public records, and, this is the part I love, using a taser on a civilian in exchange for cash and concealing embezzlement. The Attorney General office filed charges on February 11th against the current and former public officials of the city, according to a statement released by the sheriff's office. Barry, Florida or not?
What? This certainly could be Florida. I mean, let's, you know, there's Florida and corruption and politics literally go hand in hand and have forever. Coin flip on this one. Is it too obvious that I'm going to say it's not Florida?
Armstrong, Iowa. I think this is
wow.
I've ever gone to Iowa in one of our stories, Barry.
No.
How cool is that? So do you got one for me?
No, I don't. I don't have.
Okay. One. Well, I got a second one for you then.
All right.
Mr. Heavy Preparation.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, next story, Barry. Locals are being told to stay away from country lanes and to keep their pets at home to avoid frightening, quote, a black panther that has been roaming the streets. According to police, the animal, a large black cat, has escaped his home where he was being kept by someone in the mafia. Allegedly, we don't know for sure. There is, in fact, a mafia. But, Barry, Florida or not?
Oh, this is a tough one, too, because when you say mafia, the first thing that comes into mind for me is somewhere up in the Northeast, whether it's New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia. That's what I think of. But, look, we all know that the mafia exists in Hollywood, Florida.
Allegedly.
Yeah. You know, what was that? Joe Sonkin's Gold Coast Inn. Remember that place?
I will neither confirm or deny that.
All right, because apparently that was like the winter headquarters. But you're also saying a large cat roaming free, and certainly that would be the climate. I'm going to say Florida on this one.
It is, in fact, in Bari in Puglia, Italy. We're going across the pond. I can't believe you didn't get that little.
No.
The fact, again, there may or may not be the mafia in Italy. That's strictly, you know. So, Barry, one for one you went on that. So you're batting 500, which would get you in the Hall
for
of Fame.
But that's great.
Yeah, it's another story. So, Barry, let's discuss what's been happening in our funniest movie of the last 50 years tournament. Thoughts, views, comments so far.
Yeah, it's I think I really like the direction of our group as far as the voting. Not that it should matter, you know, but at the end of the day, you know, I think every film that I would think should win has won. And certainly when you had Stripes versus Midnight Run, that's a tough one. But at the same time, I love Midnight Run. It's in my top 10 favorite movies. But Stripes is an American classic when it comes to comedy. So I'm extremely proud of the group. I think the tournament's great. I love the fact that Mrs. Bowdrin is doing the blind draws on this. How long is this going to go on for? We've got like
as long as it takes.
I like it.
So I have two questions for the group, and we will post these in the group tomorrow. As it stands right now, today's ballot, at the time we were recording this is Beverly Hills Cop. Very funny movie. Eddie Murphy versus The Sure Thing. And as I had to explain to Nick Bazance, hope I'm pronouncing that right, Nick. He said, I've never even heard of The Sure Thing. I sent him a picture of Nicolette Sheridan. And he said, I'm going to have to watch that movie now, which is pretty much the response that anyone would have because she was on fire. Say it, Barry.
Fire!
Thank you. She was on fire. But as of now, the voting, oh, Barry, 110 votes for Beverly Hills Cop, 8 votes for The Sure Thing. So my first question is, if we get a separation of more than 100 votes, should we just end the vote at that point? What do you think, Bear?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, okay. Yeah, we're not going to be able to make
it. Okay. Second question is, because this is going good, and I said, this is a, just to paraphrase what we talked about, AEW, this is slow marinating poll. We've got, you know, I'm now up to, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of 120 movies that I've got picked out. So in theory, the first round could friggin' go like until past Christmas. Okay. So would you like to see you, the voters? I'm going to ask Barry Rose to speak on your behalf. Would you like to see more than just one vote per day?
Ooh.
In other words, should we have like, say, 4 movies, you know, one against the other. And then a couple hours later, we put another poll up with 2 more movies. So we do 2 in one day. What do you think of that, Bear?
I would say no, and I'll tell you why. I think it'll dilute the importance of what we're doing. I think if you start to put up 3 and 4 different posts where the movies are going against each other, it's going to be hard to be able to keep up with it. I like the fact that it may take a month or two or until Christmas or until the year 2023, because it's something that I think we can log into the group and we can see every day. And I like it. I like having, you know, it's kind of like what I've been doing in the CWF group with that pick a card deal. I've been doing that for almost 8 years at 8 o'clock at night, 7 days a week. And we get, you know, some days we get 80 to 90 comments with, you know, 30 or 40 different people checking in. I like that. I like the continuity of that. So I vote 2 movies per day going head to head, but certainly.
Oh, okay. Let me ask a variation of that. Friend of the show, Howard Brody, suggested that maybe not every day, certainly, but maybe once a month, we do the 3-way dance. We have 3 movies
like
on
it.
The ballot.
I like
you
it.
Like that?
Yep, I do.
Okay, I'm going to put all 3 of those questions up for the group so we can discuss that. So now, Barry, I know that you love nothing more than a good food question. Am I right? Okie dokie. So as I mentioned to you the night, we went out to a local restaurant called Bad Daddy's, which is a kind of a burger joint. I've shown pictures on the group before. They have a lovely bacon that they dip in buttermilk and then deep fry. Boy, it's good, Barry. So what I mentioned to Barry was we went there the other night for the first time on a Saturday evening. We usually go during the week, and the place was really crowded. And the waitress that we like to get, her name is Michaela, and Michaela was dealing with a party of, I want to say between 30 and 35 guests, very big party. And so when the people finally left and we were still sitting there and she came over to talk with us, my wife asked her, did you get gratuity that would be commensurate with having a party that large? And she kind of looked and she put a little smirk on her face and she says, well, let's just say that some people in the group took care of me properly and others completely ignored me. Okay. Which is, wow, there's just nothing quite as frustrating as that, Barry. And so then I, of course, ask, well, you know, when you have a party that size, does the restaurant not make some sort of, note on the bill that, you know, a party this size, 20% is the normal gratuity. If you want to do a little bit more, that's fine, but it has to be at least 20%. And she says, no, here at the restaurant, they don't make us do that, or they don't let us do that. So boom, Barry Rose, restaurant manager, tell us your thoughts on that policy.
Yeah. So the reason you wouldn't do it is that some people will be offended, you know, and it's, I've worked in restaurants where we've included the gratuity for, say, of a party over 6 or a party over 8. And then we have had people say that, you know, well, I don't like being forced to have to leave a tip. I can make up my own mind, my own judgment. And then invariably, the same people always say, I was going to leave more, which, you know, is just total bullshit. Exactly. You absolutely hate that. That would be the main reason, is so as not to anger a diner. At the same time, restaurants that do that usually communicate it in three ways. One, it's on the menu. You look at the menu, parties of eight or more, a 15 to 20% gratuity will be added to your check. The second way it's communicated when somebody calls to make a reservation or walks in the restaurant, either the hostess or whoever answers the phone would say, we'd like to add, you know, 15 or 20% gratuity. So allowing them that way. The server, when they're taking the order, should also reiterate that, you know, a gratuity is going to be added. Will that be fine with everybody? In most cases, it is. By not doing that is really where the bigger issue comes. Because what happens now is you said it was what, 30 to 35 people?
Correct.
So 30 to 35 people at $15 a pop, and my math sucks, but you're looking at somewhere like a $450, a $500 check. So you're looking at a significant chunk of change. And in most cases, I don't know what Georgia is, you know, California where Sweet Lou is, it's completely different. But in most cases, a tipped position is going to see roughly $3 an hour. So it's impossible to pay your bills on $3 an hour, having no idea if this woman pays rent, has children, car payments, whatever it might be. By not doing this, the restaurant has sent a very clear message that we are not going to take care of our staff. And what's going to happen is this young lady who got screwed out of a tip is going to invariably have some sort of chip on her shoulder now. She's going to be like, you know, fuck this restaurant. I come in here, I bust my ass. I do everything that you asked me to do. I'm great with my guests. I'm a conscientious employee, and you know, I'm working my ass off. And I potentially, I could have made, $100 off of this table. Instead, I'm walking out with 20. But the restaurant doesn't have my back with this. She now is going to have a bad attitude because she's coming in and busting her ass and she's not being compensated for it. With that, she's either going to have a bad attitude or she's going to wind up quitting. Attrition in restaurants is one of the biggest challenges that they face. The cost of hiring and training a new employee is astronomical. So instead of putting 20, 18% a gratuity on a check for a server who has earned her money. Conceivably, we're assuming she's earned her money. Instead, you're saying, I'm not going to support her. She's going to quit. You're going to go have to hire and train another employee. And let me tell you, it costs a lot of money to do that. So I think it's a big mistake. I think that as long as a guest is not being blindsided with the gratuity being added to a check. And that really is the key right there. As long as they know before they place their order that a gratuity is going to be added, I don't see any issue whatsoever. Because if you don't like that policy, then you have every right to stand up and go eat somewhere else.
Well, okay, let me just ask you this. So obviously if it's a party of like, say, 6 to 10 people, that's one thing. But if it's a party of that size, we're talking 30 to 35 people, is it on the server to do it, or should the manager come over and be the one to tell them?
Well, the manager should. As a former restaurant manager, you can't always count on us to do it. That's for sure.
You wanted to say that again, didn't you? As a former restaurant manager,
how dare you?
How dare you, sir?
Yes. But it's incumbent that it's on the website. When you look at their menu, it's on the website. If I look at the menu in-house, it should be there. If I've called to make a reservation, whoever takes that reservation should be communicating that. And then when they walk in, let's say they don't have a reservation, it's a party of 10 walking in, they would need to hear this as well. Should a manager walk over and say it again? The only thing is you don't want to come off. You don't want to embarrass anybody, and that can be
a— Of course not. No, I get that. Right.
But a server can always do it in a very nonchalant way. Hey, you know, policy of the restaurant, we always put 20% on for parties over eight, and just kind of say it matter-of-factly and do it. Again, you've always got the one goofball who's going to say, oh, I was going to leave 30% or I would leave 40%, you know, which, again, history tells me that that's a load of shit. But, you know, it's a sensitive thing. I get it. But at the same time, if you don't have the backs of your employees, you are not going to succeed in any business.
Okay, so we are heading for the go home. I have three more things to talk about very quickly, Barry, since we all know that you claim that Die Hard is a Christmas movie. Yes, of course, sir. Still dispute it. Which is more of a Christmas movie, Die Hard or Die Hard 2? Boom.
Maybe Die Hard 2 is more of a Christmas movie. I prefer Die Hard 1, but if we're looking at what is a more a Christmas movie, I think Die Hard 2 might be, yes.
Okay, so next, I happen to be listening to, believe it or not, Barry, I don't know if you're going to be shocked by this, I listen to other podcasts.
What?
Some that got Ozzy upset.
Oh, yeah.
Some that are not on the Arcadian Network, sorry to say. I was listening to, believe it or not, a hockey podcast. Oh. And one of the questions they were talking about, they were discussing favorite cereals, breakfast cereals. What is your favorite breakfast cereal if you're having one?
Fruity Pebbles or Cocoa Pebbles. It's one of those two.
Okay. Gunny must have heard Ozzy because he came over to say hello. So now that being said, have you ever heard of this? Usually you put the cereal in a bowl, put the milk on top of the cereal. So the host of this particular hockey podcast was talking about breakfast cereals, says he puts the milk in the bowl first, then puts the cereal on top so that it doesn't get soggy. Have you ever heard of that? Have you ever done that, Barry Rose?
No, I always put the milk right on top of the cereal.
Would you be amenable to trying it that way?
I would, but you know what I like? I like when the milk covers it. In my head, I'm thinking if I've got the bowl of milk and I put the cereal on top, the cereal is going to float for a little bit. And I don't want floating in my cereal.
Okay. Yes. Well, no, floaters are not good, so to say. So finally, as we're wrapping up the show here, Barry, you know, while your situation in life has been currently been going through some highs and lows, some ups and downs, and now that you're in the new Palatial Studios, I can now talk about something that we've been kind of putting off until all this was done. Friend of the show and former attendee at the CWF Legends Fan Fest, Tom Hale, reached out to me and said, "Hey, what is going on with Unsolved Mysteries?" And I said, "Well, that, again, Ozzy popping for that reference. You know,
what a reaction.
Way to go, Oz. Yes.
Yeah, Ozzy.
I can tell you that at the time this comes out, within the next 3 to 4 episodes, Tom Hale and those who have wondered, Unsolved Mysteries returns. Boom! Take it home, Lou. You know, I do a friggin' boom, go home, Lou, and I forgot to say, of course, the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowder and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Thank you so kindly. Let me try it again. Boom! Take it home, Lou.